Welcome back to Warp Celluloid. I'm your host, Jack Rourke, or co-host, I should say. With me. Oh, fucking hell, I already fucked this up right out of the gate.
No, you're good.
With me here right now is the esteemed, wonderful, always insightful
Chandler Williams. Thank you, Jack, for the generous preamble. And we have one of our
hype man's got a
yeah.
hype.
We have one of our best buds here with us joining. It's been a while since.
Would you care to introduce yourself, our friend?
Go for it.
Hey guys, it's me, Nico Candela. Very excited to be here again. I'm very happy to join this podcast again with these two studs that I haven't seen in so long. You know, Mr. Worldwide is back. You know, what can I say? Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Worldwide himself.
Yep. And
Mr. 305, baby.
A very...
Mr. 305.
Or the 90210, considering what we're discussing today.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned previously, we're starting out with a slate of films that we're going to be alternating between Chandler's picks and mine's. This week is going to be mine, and to follow up Alan Pakula's The Parallax View, I have selected one of the most gleefully psychotic studio movies ever greenlit, Tony Scott's Domino.
Okay, Domino, you're with me on the side. Choco, you cover the rear.
My name is Domino Harvey. I am a bounty hunter. You're probably wondering how a girl like me arrived here.
I'm here to ask you a few questions.
What I say will determine whether or not I spend the rest of my life in prison.
I'll tell you everything I know.
Let's start at the beginning. My father died when I was a little girl. After Dad passed on, Mum was determined to move us to Beverly Hills.
That 90210 world. It's not for me.
What's it like to have the body of a 10-year-old boy?
Have you had a nose job?
No.
In the end, it all came down to fate. That's Ed Mosby.
The most legendary bounty hunter in all of Los Angeles.
Why would a delicate little thing like you want to be a bounty hunter?
I want to have a little fun. That's my best friend, Choco.
He's always fancied me.
What you looking at, darling?
Nothing.
We may have been dysfunctional, but we worked.
We were family.
36 hours ago, $10 million was stolen from an armored car.
Don't any of you make a peep.
Let's see you, Barbara.
Freeze the tape. That's a damn first, ladies.
Where's my money?
I can deliver these thieves to you. I employ bounty hunters.
No one could have expected what happened next.
Get off.
Little did I know that the $10 million
belonged to the mob.
Want me to shoot him in the kneecaps?
Sounds like an inside job to me.
That's where it all went wrong.
Do you know this man?
He's a producer. He wanted to put his goals on television.
I'm just going with batons and nunchucks.
Use nunchucks. Nunchucks are good.
You can make this easy, or you can make it real complicated.
That doesn't make any sense.
There are three kinds of people in the world. The poor.
Come on.
The rich.
Tonight.
What was you trying to do?
Told you the
what
story.
Are you doing over this?
Let's go home right now.
And everyone in between. My name is Domino Harvey.
This is fascinating.
Where to begin with such an absolute work of controlled chaos? I think Chandler was telling me this before we got on the mic, is there's a lot to unpack with this movie.
For sure, and before we started recording, Jack and I, we both had the same first note of like, this is the most 2000s thing I've ever seen, aside from maybe Southland Tales, which, you know, it's Richard Kelly, so that checks out. But yeah, I mean, I don't even know how to accurately verbally describe the visual style at play here, like, other than just, you know, it's like, we were also saying before we started recording, it's like what drinking a Four Loko feels like, but visually.
It's funny. I got the text from Nico last night. Like, this is if you doused Baz Luhrmann in Four Lokos. And funny enough, this I got maybe an even more insane take that I'm going to say for later in the show. I think the only studio movie that comes close to this in like the last 20 years might be Baz Luhrmann's Elvis. I don't have a lot of specifics except for one broad point, but I will get to it later. later. I promise I'm going somewhere with this. This isn't Jack having his red string and newspaper clippings and sticky notes with what does it all mean?
No, no, we'll get there. I mean, that was my first take. Nika, what was your first thought?
I actually have it written down here. My first note was literally, holy shit, the film grain. And yeah, that was my first thought, was just like, immediately as you watch the movie, like the very first thing you're met with is just an insane, like over the top saturation of the film grain. And yeah, like you're just immediately met with how hypersensitive, how hyper focused this is going to be. It's insane. Like how, whoa, like just the green and everything like that. It's just so hyper active. Yeah, that's probably what I gotta say about that, you know. It's crazy. It's genuinely so crazy.
If this movie were like a 90s underground band, it would be called something like Narcotic Stimulation Overload or some shit.
It did feel very music video like.
Which I think is a fairly apt way of describing it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, every sequence felt like a music video in a lot of ways, or at least like every shot looks like it could have been in a music video. Just like that high contrast, high saturation, that kind of like activated grain. And then the whole like whip cutting, you know, cross fading, double exposure, cut to black and white for like half a second, like upside down shots. I don't even know how to like verbally go into all the details of like the technical elements. I mean, I could tell you, but that wouldn't do it justice of like of what they're choosing to do. Like, this was a conscious decision. And
yeah, no, it feels like Tony Scott just breathing down his editor's neck, like some poor PA on the editing team who's like doing some cutting reels or whatever, just going, this cut isn't less than 3 seconds long. I'm gonna fucking murder you. Like, I swear to God, like him just bouncing around the walls, like, ah.
I mean,
that's basically how I described it for sure.
Oh no, I've heard Tony Scott is an absolute joy on set.
I don't ever imagine Tony Scott ever being that way. As much as his movies indicate that.
I mean, I love that he always wears the same like camo, not camo. What color am I thinking of? Like khakis, right? Like the same like vest and like ball cap they're wearing. He's got the cigar in his mouth. He's like, all right, let's shoot this fucker. Right, like the man just has an excitement and a kinetic glee, at making something that makes you feel viscerally alive. And I'm glad you guys started out with the technical elements, because there is one thing you need to go into this movie, right? And I think it is genuinely crucial to even beginning to get on board with the thing, let alone liking it or understanding it. You can't dissociate this movie with heavy, just constant inundation of absolutely depraved drug use. A lot of the stylistic tics are there to mimic what Scott eventually found as he was doing research on bounty hunters for the film. He had known the real Domino Harvey, which we will get into much later, for about 10 years before Rick Kelly actually had a draft of the script out before they started shooting. And one of the biggest things he noticed was frequent use of our old friend Mr. Nose Candy.
Nose Candy.
This film, aside from the already established setup of Domino is on mescaline in this interrogation sequence and all of these memories are, let's say, not to be taken entirely literally throughout it. Like, it forms a clear picture if you keep following the threads, but the experience of itself is supposed to rattle you in your your skull. It's absolutely just, man, there really is very few things like this. And I mention this because there's a very special way this movie was shot. Tony, by now in the 2000s, we'd already seen it begin to take place a little bit with stuff like Crimson Tide, even though that might be, in my opinion, the last classically made Tony Scott film. Like, that has the more of the refined shots go on long, colors are saturated, but not pushed to the toxic edge that we were talking about earlier, But like, he made big budget studio movie or an action blockbusters look as good as they could possibly dream of being. The guy just had an innate skill for it. And in the 2000s, with the emergence of technology and the internet and all of the miasma that follows in its wake, he decides, no, I'm not going to get quiet and grow old. I'm going to keep pushing. I'm going to keep finding new ways to show this stuff. And I'm just going to keep challenging myself. And when you do it with a movie like this, that movie as instantly hard to get on board with, hard to pin down, and understandably divisive, you have to go the go big or go home approach. Or like, you can't do any half measures. You can't pull your punches. You can't really like miss the shot. You have to go for it, and you have to show, I am in this for the long haul.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that it's a harmonious relationship between the visual style and the story itself, because, I mean, like, the story's takes place, I mean, the present, most recent, you know, part of the story would be the interview, which they cut back and forth to, but also, they're jumping across time, the whole movie. And, I mean, the story itself is audacious and bold and raunchy and vulgar, and I think the visual style matches that equally. And, yeah, I mean, I'm not the biggest Tony Scott fan, but I can't help but respect him of, like, embracing the times and even, like, pushing what would be, like, the modern style at the time, in 2005.
Yeah. I'm going to say, considering how lukewarm you are on Maverick, I imagine the original Top Gun's not going to do it for you, but if I were to recommend two other movies, especially based on your interest in this, True Romance and The Last Boy Scout, those are the ones to prioritize. But going back to the technicals, I mention all of this because the way he reflects it is, if you were to just take this in something like a Harmony Korine or a Sean Baker film, something with a smaller budget, this would be talked about as a form of experimentation. And it would be taken like, hey, what the hell is this guy actually doing in here? Because if this movie looks irradiated and toxic and truly blown out of proportion, that's not an accident. And before filming started, they took the 35mm stocks and did a process that they, I believe DP Dan Mindel, and Bill called cross-processing, where you take Kodak stock or Eastman and process it with materials from the other company or send it to them to where the colors come out blown out. Reds are particular or what stands out with them. The grain increase is, but also in regards to the slow motion, because the film is so utterly finally fitting that we get to a movie on warped celluloid that actually shoots on warped celluloid, funny enough. I just thought of that on the spot. God damn, I'm good.
Good shit, but
that, but anyway, anyways, it also means that because it's so transmogrified, you can't crank this the way you can mechanically really now, like the standard tradition. You have to go back to hand cranking, which means lower frame rates, increased shutters, like all those chemical blurs and light leaks that define his work of this time. Like, this is definitely a continuation of Men on Fire and absolutely has ideas that you're going to see in his next movie, Deja Vu.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, too, how for me it was like watching this, I was thinking Michael Bay saw this and just never looked back. You know, with how his movies have looked. Because it definitely reminded me a lot of, Southland Tales and of, for sure, like, as far as Michael Bay goes, as far as the visual style and just the absolute nonstop bombardment of hectic moments, Transformers, at least his first one, and yeah, Pain and Gain is definitely the movie that comes most to mind. But yeah, no, it's just like it has such a grungy look to it. It's almost like this movie was poisoned or something. Like it has this feeling of intoxication and just toxicity all throughout the movie. Like it's like you could smell this movie. It feels so so dirty and grimy. It's such a weird little movie, you know.
Or they're right outside Chernobyl and they're interviewing like people with like weird back growths and like distorted faces. Like it is It is a movie that absolutely commits it to itself, like a lot like Oliver Stone's Natural Born Killers, as a funhouse mirror to the current trashiness.
Yeah, I think it embraces it too. And I mean, on the show we've reviewed a lot of older movies, and I think we're both reluctant to use the term dated, but you know, I think this transcends the word and term dated, and it's very of its time, which I think is a nicer thing to say. Yeah, it reminds me of like of watching like Fear Factor reruns, or you know, stuff like that. Just takes me back to being a child, and I think I would have loved this a lot more when it came out, if I was like 13 when it came out.
Oh, I could absolutely see like a teenage with like a Pixies CD right in the back of his car. Yeah. Or a car with this poster like being front and center the second you enter his room.
Like a puka shell necklace.
Like, yeah, man, this movie's so fucking cool. It's got Keira Knightley with a pixie cut. She's got the AK-47s in her apartment. Yeah. Mickey Rourke's a scumbag, and he did the same year as Sin City. Oh, it's so fucking awesome. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, you get to see Keira Knightley's boobs.
She gives a dude. She gives a bunch of dudes a lap dance, bro. Which, oh my!
Yeah.
I think that might be the scene for me where I'm like, oh shit, they're really going for this.
How old was she when she made this? Like 19? She was like 18 or 19.
I think she did this right after Curse of the Black Pearl, after Pirates of the Caribbean, yeah. Curse of the Black Pearl. So I'd assume like.
I mean,
like
she's 22 when this is happening, according to Real History. Okay, I just realized we've been recording for, 15 minutes now, and we haven't even started to dissect what this thing is about. Right, it's all just been a blur of, oh my god, you guys have to see this incredible thing. Like, us sputtering out of wherever we're seeing this, like, wind-up toys.
Oh yeah, like, for me, that lap dance scene, like you were mentioning, I feel like that's such an absurd scene that you have to, once you reach that scene, you're either in or you're out. You either have to buy all the way in or not buy in at all.
But don't buy it too much, is the point. Again, I will bring up pink glowing Tom Waits in the middle of the desert.
I love Tom Waits.
Which, that absolutely had... That had to be a Richard Kelly touch, right? That right, because that feels like a joke he would throw in.
Yeah, I mean, there are... I mean, just to preface, Donnie Darko is my favorite movie. And so, I mean, that being said, I'm a big fan of Richard Kelly, really just for Donnie Darko. But there's so much of Southland Tales in this movie, you know, not supporting the war in Afghanistan.
And just the absurdity of it all, the excess, the post 9/11 culture,
the government, the use of, police force, just a general, like kind of post grunge broody tone. That's very angsty and very raunchy, and very like kind of mean and full of itself, but in a way that's much more empathetic than Southland Tales or you know, anything that Michael Bay has ever done.
I would totally agree there. This movie feels like it's a lot more sympathetic towards its subject than anything Michael Bay has done, like you said. And I really enjoy that Scott has such a hold over his visual style and has such a control over such a chaotic, I would call it like controlled chaos. He's able to control the chaos in a way where it doesn't really feel like the chaos is controlled, but it's not all over the place. I admire that so much about him and his stories that he tells too, where he's telling something so chaotic and absurd, but also he has so much heart, and I think he is a lot more emotionally intelligent and emotionally resonant than someone like, I would say, Michael Bay, whose movies I also admire too, of course.
I mean, the only other like really Richard Kelly things that reminded me of Donnie Darko in this were like Tom Waits' character, just for some reason, and the use of his songs. And then like the shots of the coin flipping, where it's like clearly CGI, like the coin flipping into the sky, and the sky is like on like a time lapse of like some foreboding clouds. It felt like, you know, he got that check and was just like riding while coked up, and you know, full of himself. I feel like everyone on this crew, like, just knew they were just making money and, you know, just they could do whatever they want. And I think it works. Yeah.
No, I totally agree. I think this movie definitely works, but I do agree that they took no reservations whatsoever when making this movie. They were all just like, fuck it. Let's throw everything out there. Let's just figure out what's going to work, what's not going to work. Who cares? Let's just have some fun, you know? I definitely believe that it's a very insane movie, but
oh yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of weird too. You would think that there was an executive in the sidelines kind of trying to manage this, and probably Tony Scott going like, shut the fuck up. What are you doing here? Get out of here. This is my movie.
They want to make it safe.
Yeah, like you would think that would be like somebody.
Like, commodify it.
The scene that sticks out in my mind with it is, first off, I should mention that True Romance being compared to this movie is not an accident at all. And not just because of this. Both movies have absolute barn burners of supporting turns from Christopher Walken. Here he is being a very specific parody of a TV executive whose name escapes me, but that's neither here nor there, but just the way, like, you hear him in the van and he's, like, dodging and he's, like, clearly getting a kick out of what he's seeing in the monitors as the dailies are coming in. And he's like, the font's not right! And like, little messy things, I'm like, why do you care about this so much? But and he's clearly having fun, but eventually that transmutates into something a little uglier while still being screamingly funny. I think he's introduced as, like, a ferret on crystal meth, written by another character.
No, I was gonna say, like, Christopher Walken showing up, I have it in my notes right here. For me, it was like opening, like, cracking ammonium salts right in front of your nose. Just like, pow!
Pow!
You know, like, what's going on here? What's going on with the font? The fonts! As soon as he shows up, he immediately just elevates the movie tenfold and makes it so much more fun and exciting, and I feel like he added so much to the movie.
His, I mean, relatively minor role really elevated the movie for me, and it kind of made me see it as like, oh, this is like, they're like, you know, Christopher Walken's in this. This is like super reputable now. Which is like a cheap thing to say and admit that that's the way I felt.
Reputable is one of the last words on my mind with this movie.
Yeah, like,
but it wouldn't work if it was.
You know what I mean? I mean, reputable is not the best word to use, but like, oh, this is like
credible.
This is a real movie. Like, yeah, credible. Like, this is a real movie. Christopher Walken's in it.
And what I really appreciated too was how this is him, not really like how he is now, where he's sort of just doing things and he's kind of accepted being a meme, or even then, like, and then some of the stuff that he's a lot more serious, like, for example, Dune 2. Instead here, it's not like, it's 20 years ago, but this is a much more energetic peak Christopher Walken, where he's just at his most bizarre and at his most energetic. All the quick cuts to him back and forth, I think he's just a perfect microcosm for the movie.
It's a very difficult tightrope to walk, I think. Going back to Southland Tales for a minute, I jokingly called this the good version of Southland Tales to Chandler, because eagle-eared, rather, listeners will remember that we were going to cover that movie for an episode of the show, but quite frankly, we were so bummed out by the thing after watching it that I'm like, this is going to be a miserable thing to record. Do we really? I straight up asked him if he wanted to pull the plug on this, and I got a brief mention in the episode we did instead, which was for Cameron Crowe's Vanilla Sky. But here, I mentioned that because I remember the thing I focused on was the needle drop of The Killers, where it has Justin Timberlake lip syncing to it with the dog tags and the blood on his shirt, or with the dancers. It's a very well choreographed scene, and as its own thing, incredibly inspired satire on the Bush era. The problem is, that is one scene in the middle of the movie that has fuck all to do with the rest of it, and ultimately, it feels like just short bursts, inconsistent bursts of creativity that aren't given much structure or focus. Here, the vision is a lot more cohesive, even if it is deliberately by design scatterbrain. And I think, yeah, this is a movie that you cannot separate from the War on Terror era. Like, this is peak W. Bush era cinema. If I were to give, like, a guy 50 or 100 years in the future two mainstream American movies to get a sense of the culture, I would give him this, and I would give him the Will Ferrell Will Ferrell vehicle Talladega Nights.
Nice.
Because, good God, you're instantly going to get a bomb of, wow, that was that is a chemical fucking flashback of 2005.
I mean, you forgot my favorite.
The sunglasses.
The sunglasses. Oh my gosh, yeah. Mickey Rourke.
The wraparound shades.
And my favorite part about the Justin Timberlake sequence is that they're in a fucking arcade, you know, for no reason. And he's like wearing a military uniform. And one of my coworkers swears by that movie. And I've been meaning to rewatch it and give it another chance.
It's fine if it doesn't click for you. I have some buddies who are like, Jack, you really got to see this absolutely unholy train wreck of a thing. I understand why it attracts them to it. But there's at a certain point that I reach with that movie that just, I can't click with it. And there's a part of my brain that just keeps insisting, no, this doesn't work. This keeps falling apart in on itself. I want to love this, but there's so much. It's a movie that in a lot of ways feels like it's at war with itself. In a way that this manages to do that bout. The thing you can ultimately give this thing credit for, and it's worth noting because when this came out, it was completely and utterly despised by most people who saw it. And most of the intelligentsia was like, oh, this is just, this is fucking trash.
Yeah, it's got 18% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Which I don't want to linger on it, but I don't want to be the guy who says, oh, they just didn't fucking get it, but they really didn't fucking get what this was going. I think a lot of the takes in this on the negative are just an insistence of this is just disingenuous and hollow. Oh, and I think it's just, and I get it if the opening loses you. This is a movie that if you're not on board from frame one, good luck keeping up with the rest of it. And I'm not even talking about keeping track of the story. I mean, if you are not settled into the vibe of this and knowing what you're getting into, I can understand that being a nightmare experience. I do, but, and it's worth mentioning, this might be one of the few movies that Film Twitter has authentically willed into being a cult classic. Thank you, Vulgar Auteurism, which I might add, it's so fucking insane that a Film Twitter term has its own Wikipedia page, right?
No way.
Wow.
Wait, it has a Wikipedia page?
Oh yeah, it does. And funny enough, Michael Bay is like at least like a 25% of that page. You can look it up. That word once again, vulgar auteurism, which I think very much applies here.
For sure.
Which is what the people who did shout out this movie and the people who did defend it when it came out, because it's not like any mainstream audience saw that this thing cost $50 million, definitely did not recoup that. But Tony already had Deja Vu lined up, so it was kind of a. It was a bomb, but it wasn't exactly a career ender for many involved.
You cannot put that guy in director jail, or at least while he was still alive. Rest in peace, of course. But like you look at the filmography of Tony Scott, and you see a movie like this, and it's like, dude, I think you see a lot of vulgar auteurism in today's day and age that has been very responsible for putting directors in so-called director jail. He avoids that so well. It's so funny to me. Because he could come out with something like this or something even more batshit insane. And it wouldn't matter because he's Tony fucking Scott.
It almost happened to him with that remake of The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. An interesting movie that is a remake of a much better movie that, from what I hear, ultimately just kind of falls apart. But it's an interesting failure is the term I've heard it labeled under. But back to this, one of the major champions of this movie, and it cannot be ignored, and it's absolutely worth reading his piece about it, Roger Ebert loved this.
Wow.
I mean, borderline. Like, he did put some qualifiers in there, but there's a quote from this movie that I think ultimately, one, surmises his point quite eloquently and simply, but also gets what I found in this, and apparently a lot of other people are finding in this too. It's fractured and it's maddening, but it's alive.
For sure.
To explain the plot, and considering how much this movie blends fact and fiction, and like a filmmaker we're going to cover in future, Ken Russell, really likes to play with the absurdity and looseness of history when you're detached from it. And so I feel like it's only fitting to start where this movie began conceptually. And Domino Harvey was a very regular fixture of the L.A. scene, both in the 90s and up until her death in around 2005. Of a fentanyl overdose, which is very odd to read that when a lot of the headlines around this whole scare don't really exist until, like, 2020. 2020. Like, it's weird that this is something we're just now talking about, but again, neither here nor there. Scott became very good personal friends with her over drinks, and the stories she'd share, and just the absolute commanding Livewire personality that made the wires click in his head, where he's like, holy shit, I need to make a movie about her. This is larger than life. I can absolutely do this. Richard Kelly gets involved soon after, once Donnie Darko takes off. The script, which I actually was able to skim through before we started recording, if you want to find it online, I'll put the link in the description. And I think I sent it to Chandler a few months ago, before we got on the mic. There are ultimately some minor differences, I think. I find some of the weird reflexive, this isn't nearly as good as the script. Is it really, though? Because the changes I noticed were fairly minor. Like, instead of an exhibit needle drop in the opening, it's you two and Johnny Cash as the Wanderer, which actually might have fit better, but again, nitpick. It's really just a minor matter of aesthetics and a certain organization of material and how it's shown. But a lot of this movie's DNA is baked into it, I think.
Yeah, you mentioned the needle drops. Also very of its time. Not just the songs themselves. I mean, some of the songs were released much earlier than the film was released, but the use of the needle drops, and the scene that really comes to mind is whenever the guy like gets his arm cut off with a shotgun in the RV. They use Mama
like Scarface level violent.
Mama told me not to come. I don't know, like the use of having a song come in like in the middle of the chorus feels very of its time. It's something that, I mean, that's a kind of a personal pet peeve of mine, because I feel like it cheapens the song and inadvertently deflates the tone. But that's one hell of a scene for sure. Just, yeah.
It's memorable.
Yeah.
You're not going to forget anything like that anytime soon. I'll tell you that. But it's interesting that you bring that up. Because I think it works a little better than you do, but I understand why it doesn't work for you, if I may. I hate to harp on the whole tightrope metaphor, but I can agree that this is the exact kind of needle drop that you could imagine another filmmaker doing a hell of a lot worse, and in fact has, even if I can't name specific examples off the top of my head. But I think the thing that saves it here is that this movie has irony on its side, when it's not being sincere and caring about its protagonist, who, if we haven't mentioned, I'm going to let her explain for herself.
I am a bounty hunter.
It really communicates just the pain of the moment in a very darkly funny way of it. It's basically the sound equivalent of pouring rubbing alcohol on a gaping open cut, like the size of your left tendon. Like, hey, Jesus, you need to get to the hospital as soon as humanly possible. Well, like, this is going to sting a little. I think it is a very conscious choice. It doesn't feel lazy or like, fuck it, just throw that scene in there. I'll make it, that song in there, and it'll make it funny enough. Like, there's purpose behind it.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that.
Even if you could call it a malfunction.
I don't disagree with that. It feels like it cheapens the song. And I mean, back to the cocaine analogy for the style of this film. You know, whereas I would put like Boogie Nights or Goodfellas as in like you got clean, good, pure cocaine. This is like some, you got a little bit of PCP in there. It's like maybe a little bit of fentanyl in there. You know, maybe it's just some dirt or ash. Like it's not as clean.
Get some mescaline in there.
Oh,
just,
yeah,
like,
for sure.
The some dumpings mescaline. From an ashtray that was sitting in the corner of the living room whenever.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're just like, you know, storing some ash as well.
No, dude, this is such a dirty film.
Yeah.
It's just, there's so much dust, there's so much dirt, ash, there's so much. It's like someone stepped on the film grain, honestly, and then just licked it and never washed its hands and never sanitized it.
It's still got that,
every
like,
single scene in this
frantic
movie, no matter if it's an LA office or like a trailer park in the middle of the fucking desert, looks like it's just got a coat of like grime that's been covering it and caking on for like the last 5 years. It gives it, and this word was especially focused on in the making of interviews that I saw, texture. It is a very gross, it's a movie that you I think movies ultimately operate on two states of mind: emotional truth and logical truth. This definitely leans into the emotional truth, valuing sensation and interrogating how it feels versus is understanding things on a simple A to B to Z rundown.
It works because at the end of the day, this is the mind of the subject. And in a way, this is the most respectful way you could have portrayed this subject, because you're giving her a spotlight in a way that isn't such a typical biopic.
Yeah, and I did like how they kind of grounded the story in, loosely grounded the story. I'll preface by saying, having to get the $300,000 for the little girl to have the surgery. Like, that felt like this put this film aside from something like Pain and Gain or anything Michael Bay or Southland Tales. It had an emotion.
Or especially Bad Boys 2.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that movie literally has Will Smith and Martin Lawrence running over corpses that are falling out of it. I think it's an ambulance or a hearse. And the fucking climax is them destroying a shantytown in Cuba. Or in Cuba, and then high-fiving each other. Like, this is like if Starship Troopers wasn't made as a set. Or at least sold as that. This is a straightforward movie. Michael Bay says, eyes darting across the room with, like, a Grinch-like evil grin.
Yeah, I mean, like, it does have an emotional grounding. Whether you think it's too small, which I would have to lean towards, or not, like, there is some emotion at play. And, like, I'd say, like, an emotional resolution of the film is, like, at the end when Keira Knightley's character says, like, I love you to her mom, you know? Like, that would not be in a Michael Bay movie.
Shout out to Jacqueline Bisset as Domino's mother, who, it's funny enough, because Lawrence Harvey, the real Domino Harvey's father, former actor, you'd know him best for The Manchuria Candidate, which you actually, if you glimpse in one of the early scenes, you can see playing on TV. Domino had her name from a model who was known by her mother. And Jacqueline Bisset was another one of those models who happened to be in contact with the same scene. So you have, along with this very modern, very then-contemporary movie, a genuine sense of, like, precedence in history. Like, that's what I mean when I want to focus on things like texture and stylistics, is that there is a lot of thought into capturing a very, not just a vibe, but a moment and how people think in that moment, which, and we keep harping on the unpleasantness of the violence. The unpleasant social politics of it all, right, is definitely part of this movie's both contradictory nature and ultimately what makes it a thing to be reckoned with, not just a disposable relic of another time. And case in point, one of the absolute barn burner, jaw-dropping, holy shit, what do I say to that after watching it? Your jaw is on the floor like you're in a Tex Avery cartoon.
I know exactly what you're going to say.
The Jerry Springer scene.
Yeah, and I think that touches also on our point of, like, you know, at the time, what was contemporary reality TV and the case of reality TV in general, but also just, like, commodifying human struggles and drama. And there's also repeated quotes from Domino about, the rich, middle class, and the poor.
The mixed race chart is insane.
I mean, man, like, the Jerry Springer episode bit, like, I don't even know what it does. I don't even know how to describe.
Yeah. Well, first off, I feel very uncomfortable quoting any line of dialogue not from Jerry Springer in that scene. But, I mean, look, there's a lot of broad gags moment to moment in the scene, like the mixed race flowchart, which killed me fucking laughing. I was falling over myself on the couch, wheezing on that gag when I first saw it. I think I saw it like 3 or 4 times by now, most recently for this, and every little time I go back to it, it's a bug that gets inside my system with this movie, and there's part of it that feel repulsive and insidious, and ultimately parts of it that almost reach profundity. And this particular scene highlights that, because after all of this, this is a cruel, debilitating, humiliating scene in a lot of ways. If it didn't have this follow-up, this could be played as incredibly fucking tone-deaf now. But there is a key line that Monique has, who I would like to add, is very good in this, and surprisingly given a lot of depth considering how little screen time she has. The line that she is given afterwards that gives this context and meaning and definitely rips your heart out after making you keel over laughing is, "Jerry Springer is all we got. They're the only ones who will listen to us." That the way to actually discuss social issues like this in this period of time with this much everyone's an angry voice coming to attention, gee, I wonder if that's relevant now.
No, and I would go on to say also that, yeah, this is such a timestamp of the mid-2000s. Yeah, exactly. It's a freak show. And going off of that too, with the internet and whatnot, this movie really has a lot of commentary on reality TV. Instead of it being about actually giving these people an outlet or showcasing these people and actually giving them a platform to be seen and heard, it's more of you're watching this circus go on. And yeah, well, admittedly, it is funny. I think that's sort of the point as you watch that scene. When you watch the very next scene after it, like you guys were saying, it's such a sobering moment because you're immediately sort of shamed in a way for even laughing at a scene like that, because, well, yes, it is ridiculous. It also is the only way that a person like her will be heard. And this movie really critiques reality so much between that, the fake IDs that she has to sell or she has to authenticate. And it has so much to comment about inauthenticity in that era, in that time. And alongside that, just, of course, the reality TV show that they, the fake reality TV show that they have in the movie with Christopher Walken. It also just serves as sort of like, this movie for me feels sort of like a reclaiming of the actual reality whilst still being entertainment at the same time.
It really highlights, like, the only spaces for these kind of conversations to make progress are the least ideal, least conducive for ones possible. So, yeah, it's going to exacerbate things. It's going to make the garbage fire even bigger.
It's a very sobering scene, the one that follows the Jerry Springer episode, like when they're talking outside the apartment complex. Like, yeah, Jerry Springer's all we got, and then maybe we could go to like BET after Jerry Springer, after getting traction, which still just sounds sad. And the internet isn't really brought up in this film whatsoever. I think she uses a computer a few times. I mean, there are
www.shutthefuckup.com. Yes,
a few use of computers, but I don't know. I was a child when this came out, so it was hard to. You know, I mean, we've kind of grown up alongside the internet, so it's hard to kind of see how social issues would have been played out aside from like a singular source of like cable TV or, you know, the dying newspapers.
I wanted to ask, so was the climax of the movie originally always going to be in the Stratosphere Hotel, or was it added later on in the movie? I was really curious. Because in the production notes, I saw that Tony Scott had gotten the rights to use the Stratosphere Hotel for the movie. But he also said that he had shot this BMW short film. He was part of a group of directors that had shot the BMW Short Film Collective. And so I was just curious.
That was there from the beginning of development. But also, it's really funny to think about anyone our age coming to this movie now without as much context, just knowing Ian Ziering from the fucking Sharknado movies. But if I may extrapolate into my own personal connection in terms of growing up as a kid of the 2000s, if we haven't mentioned it, there's a lot of divisive movies you can compare this to, and one of the ones that was, and it's the comparison's made before, I'm not saying anything new here, but it has to be mentioned, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas absolutely has a spiritual connection to this movie, I think. And not just for the setting, but that is definitely my personal connection to this, because when I think back to how I saw the city growing up, there were two things that I think of. The way Soderbergh shoots it for Ocean's 11 and 13, and the climax of this movie. movie, so much of the way the city tried to reinvent itself as the suburbs were starting to grow and as it actually became a community outside of, hey, this is a two-day town for you to gamble and drink and fuck it, and whenever you have a free weekend, it is just how much it buys into its own hype. It is absolutely as big and large and colorful and in many ways grotesque as it is in its advertising and how it chooses to show itself. And which is why I think shooting it with that glossy, like, Jerry Bruckheimer music video, when I use the phrase chemical flashback, I mean it, because I just, like, feel, like, just stunned for a sec and, like, thrown back in my seat. And we see, like, wow, they really got a moment down to the letter.
Yeah. Yeah, and seeing, like, the advertisements and billboards, like, outside the city, I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember when ads used to look like that. Which, you know, is just going back to the point of when we said, like, this movie is the epitome of a 2000s time capsule. What were you saying, Nico?
No, you were talking about the Stratosphere Hotel, and what I was trying to say with the Stratosphere Hotel was that when filming there, Tony Scott had shot something else at the Stratosphere Hotel, which was this BMW short film, which was part of this series of BMW short films that him and a couple other directors.
I got the full list in front of me right here. The full list is John Woo, Ung Lee, Neil Blomkamp, John Frankenheimer, like roughly after he shot Ronin, so this is a very cunning choice. Alejandro Gonzalez Iñárritu, Wong Kar-wai, who, funny enough, I brought up earlier, Joe Carnahan, and the broiest of the Brits himself, Guy Ritchie. Chandler, if you don't know, it was a series of short films that were commissioned by BMW. Right, yeah. Like, with narratives and action sequences, like, they are legitimate short films on top of being commercials that were ultimately made under two ultimatums. They all had to star Clive Owen as a getaway driver, and they all had to feature whatever model BMW was hot in 2000.
No, I'm familiar. I've seen the Tony Scott one, and it's pretty great. I totally forgotten about this and the connection to that, but, like, the style is, you know, pretty consistent with this as well, of, like, his contemporary style at the time.
It is such an absolute baller of a climax. If you remember that shot in the trailers of Keira Knightley, who, I might add, one of the things I kept hearing in the lead up for this and the critical drubbing I got at the time was, she is completely miscast. What the fuck were they thinking? She's not believable. I completely disagree, because I think this tapped into something she really hasn't gotten to play in the rest of her career, which is, Chandler mentioned this, the class element. And yes, Keira Knightley is absolutely someone who comes from a very posh, very classy world, but she sells the angle of, I despise everything about this culture. I hate the snippiness. I hate the cattiness. I hate that I have to be something I'm not. I want to abandon all of it and just go for a life of absolute adrenaline seek. And I'm like, it's important. And like early beats, like her punching the sorority sister in the nose, or her showing up with basically like Edge Hardy shirts and like studded leather jacket. And it's like, right, she's definitely someone from another world, but she is fully embracing something below her just because she wants to live. And in a way, that is weirdly commendable. Well, and it makes complete sense why Tony Scott chose the the classic John Ford method of printing the legend, which was the Elvis connection I alluded to earlier.
And a cool little tidbit I have, actually, just to throw it out there, of course. I have a friend of mine who I went to high school with, whose father is actually a producer and worked on a lot of Jay Bruckheimer films. And one of the movies that I discovered he worked on while doing research was this very movie itself. And talking about the Stratosphere Hotel, he actually was the executive producer who was able to book the hotel for Tony Scott to be able to use for the film. And I was like, no way. Yeah, it was really cool.
We're still deciding how to format this, because we're not going to promise like a full interview up front, but we are definitely going to keep a correspondence going and get as much detail as we can, because this is a movie we're talking about, ultimately. The point I want to arrive at, because Tony Scott is a filmmaker I've admired for a long time. I can say the same of Nico, somewhat to a lesser extent, but Chandler...
I still need to see more of his stuff.
Yeah, I wouldn't say... I do love Tony Scott, but I wouldn't say I'm an avid fan. I've only watched three of his movies, but two of them I absolutely love. Obviously, Top Gun. I love Top Gun, and I also love Maverick, too. I wouldn't be able to say which one is better. I'm a huge fan of Joseph Kosinski and his work as well. So I'm mixed on that. I'm even with both of those. But huge fan of Top Gun. And I also really love Unstoppable. That was my first introduction to Tony Scott. And I thought that was a brilliant movie as well. And I remember being like, this is sick. And I remember rewatching it too. And still being just so enamored with the style, the visuals, the performances, Denzel Washington. So yeah, big fan of Tony Scott, I think, personally.
Yeah, I almost jokingly call Tony Scott the most American British filmmaker who has ever lived, but you can say that in total sincerity and be correct. Because if you look throughout his career, he has consistently turned disreputable culture into something huge and hugely commercial and, when he's lucky, interesting. And part of that is, like this movie, he really had a knack for finding good screenwriters and getting the best material out of them. Quentin Tarantino with True Romance, Kelly with this, Shane Black with The Last Boy Scout, and Brian Helgeland with Man on Fire. Not coincidentally, four of his best movies.
Yeah.
But I think he genuinely had an eye and appreciation for the kind of Americana that is sincere without being too gross in kind of a, okay, that might be a little uncultured, shall we say, if we really want to get snobby about it, but not anything I would particularly call harmful. Well, like, there is genuine love here, not out of smashing it together, but just exploring it and let it speak for itself, which I think this movie does for its...
Well, back to your tightrope analogy, I would say this rides that to a very fine, on a very fine tightrope, because it is deeply American in its time, because there are, like, you know, a lot of explosions and a good bit of one-liners, and it's pretty raunchy and, you know, a little misogynistic at points, and just, like, cool action stuff, and you know.
Just generally shaggy, unkempt, and, I hate this word, but problematic in a way that is... Yeah, this movie would not get made like this now, and I don't want to be like one of those 60-year-old boomers who's talks about Blazing Saddles, which, one, you could absolutely make that now, you just gotta get the right people for it, but I'm not sure if we as a culture are open to seeing people this damaged, this weird, I think the movie is conscious of this too, just from having the Mickey Rourke scene where they're just interviewing him, and the producers very slowly realize, probably slower than they should, that this is not a guy who should be on television. What the fuck were you thinking? Right, like, he just clearly, like, I'm gonna be me, and to hell with whatever your concerns are, or that's just what, right, there's a very what you see is what you get quality to it.
And to go off your point about what you see is what you get, I think that this movie is unabashedly itself in a way that very much resembles and is in line with the character of Domino, who everyone seems to harp on as, you're not supposed to be her, or you're not supposed to be this grungy girl, this bounty hunter, you're a rich girl, 90210 type girl. And I think it's very telling that the 90210 actors are actors, and they're only there because they're reality stars, and they contrast so much with Keira Knightley's character with Domino. And I think that's such a perfect microcosm too for this film. And I just, in my opinion, the themes of the movie, which is that, you know, people being inauthentic, people not being who they really are. And I think the reason why this movie was so panned and so shat on was because of the fact that this movie wasn't afraid to be what it really was. It wasn't afraid to showcase Domino as she saw herself and as her life sort of was. That's the reason why people just panned it so much, because they're all judging the character and the movie's reflection of that character and the style of the movie. And it's like, that's the point. That was the point. Not to judge the character, but your reaction is the point of the movie in and of itself. You're judging this movie because it's acting like it's so cool or it's so rebellious, anti-establishment, and you're not taking her seriously purely based on her looks and who you would imagine she's supposed to be in society.
I also think since we're, I believe we're getting, near the end soon. If we're going to talk about endings, the final shot of this movie being the real life Domino Harv, warts and all, just in front of the camera, is a very telling sign of how close both Scott was to Harvey and how much this story means to him, even if it is proudly and undeniably embellished.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
the sort of part gets me every time.
Yeah, it's like, if you're wondering which parts were real or not, then, like, fuck off. Something like that. I love the last shot.
That's not what a movie's for. That's what looking up Wikipedia after you get out of the movie is for.
Yeah.
I really love how this movie is so unapologetic about the fact that this is not exactly the true story, and how at the end when Domino's is like, if you really question like if everything in this story is true, then you can go fuck yourself. I thought that was really awesome, because I thought that, yeah, it's her story to tell and she deserves to tell it how she wants to. And so I would say, like, it for me, it's just it's sad, because I feel like movies like this won't be like, they wouldn't be able to get made in today's age, because back then you at least had the video on demand market, which, you know, if your movie was a little too niche or a little too much, or it didn't quite hit all the demographics it needed to, it would find its audience on the video on demand market, and had a lot more potential of becoming a cult classic. Whereas now, you don't have that safety net. And so it makes a movie like this truly a relic of its time, because, you know, a movie like this with so much verve and absolute madness and chaos, and you feel like it probably wouldn't get made today.
I think it's to Scott's credit, actually, that the movie itself isn't the critique, but leaves itself open to critique in terms of what's shown in the ethics therein. I'm not kidding when I say this is a warts and all approach. It lets it all hang out there, which is why I'm glad you used the word respect there, because when it comes to embodying a person's spirit in a movie, which I think Tombstone does, I think Mishima Life in Four Chapters does, and I would certainly say this does in a much, much different way than Mishima, that's for sure. I doubt a Criterion disc for this is going to be coming anytime soon, is my point, but...
they'd have to be, like, running low.
I think it ultimately...
Yeah, they'd have to be, like, running low on material.
I mean, Fear and Loathing is in there, so... And also Sean Baker felt, so... It's not entirely out of the question.
No, it's
just not likely.
Yeah.
Oh, God. That just reminded me. Did you guys see the Criterion Channel lineup for next month? Or this month, by the time you hear the episode. The Razzie winner's spotlight.
Yeah.
Particularly a certain other 2000s relic that's going to be in the lineup.
I still haven't seen it. I mean, Freddy Got Fingered. I need to see it still.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Freddy Got Fingered. Yeah. I was Teddy, would you like some sausage? Another movie you could argue is an example of Dadaist trash as art.
Get out of my goddamn Scooby-Doo, you imbecile.
And he just rips it down.
Rip Torn is legitimately funny in that movie. I just wanted to say that on the record. But we're open to definitely covering that in the future, make no mistake. I mean when I say unkempt and shaggy, and not just from, again, from the scatterbrain of it all, but it is very, this is not a movie you can call sanitized, even if you can definitely call it embellished on a Hollywood, like, blockbuster scale. Like, I mentioned that this thing cost $50 million. Every penny of that $50 million was very well spent, let's just say that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's on, yeah, I mean, that's pretty evident. You can see it on screen. You can tell a lot of money went into every shot, every explosion, and, yeah, I mean, it's kind of surprising that it was as big of a budget film that it was that doesn't get talked about at all from that era.
Because if this movie were to happen now, this would be something like Neon producing it. Like, I'd picture, like, maximum $15 million budget. Or in a budget, like, it would be a lot, or the approach would be there. But in some ways, I really couldn't imagine a better way to tell the story. Studios just don't take chances on this because big canvases on some level risk a lot. And projects like this are particularly risky. But sometimes you really just gotta go for the big swings. My point was, though, you are my go-to vibes and action guy on a big scale.
But the vibes and action guy.
Yeah, man, I just, look at me. I love me some good vibes, you know, and I love me some good action movies, especially ones with heart and something to say. But I love aesthetic so much. And so, yeah, anytime you need me, I'm there.
And I'm glad we brought this back and let the time pass because I'm really excited for the future of the show. Guys, I mean, because I want to expand out the territory, and I'm glad we could do movies like this, and I'm glad that I can keep finding connections like, oh yeah, right, either introducing people close to me to movies that, if not they'll love, they'll at least stick with them, or getting things out of them that I may not have noticed before. Or I really do enjoy this, and films like this, it's why I find it a little exciting.
Absolutely, I've had a great time discussing this film, and yeah, love you guys, you know. But no, I think I would agree with Nico and be in the same boat of like, I appreciate this film and I'm glad that it exists far more than I actually like it. You know, I mean, like, there were plenty of fun sequences. I laughed a good bit, but you know, I equally like rolled my eyes at some parts and you know, yeah.
I could imagine the Deadpool version of this movie being like a million times worse.
It did, yeah.
Doing the exact same like freeze frames and title card. Regards, but doing it with like half the personality and half the
conviction. It did feel a little,
not even half if we're being
honest, a little
honest.
Deadpoolian, kind of in terms of the tone. Like it was pretty snarky a lot of the time, especially
I
the
ultimately
voiceover.
Think the difference comes in I think the difference for me ultimately comes in. The problem with Deadpool, especially post the movies, is that it does the annoying thing that satire does, or parody rather. Or that, right, it's acknowledging a thing with, and while still doing it, and not, and just pretending that there is no cognitive dissonance there. This is a film that I think, yeah, this is how it is to do it. Here's this other insane direction we're gonna go in instead. And even if the swings don't work, it takes them. It is like, we're not gonna deliver you an action movie you've seen before.
Yeah.
And in the process, it, it sticks with you. Before we wrap things up, I wanted to ask, are there any other, like, individual moments that stuck out to you or got a good laugh out of you or, oh, that was cool, man?
I think we touched about the mescaline bit. I thought that was hilarious. I mean, because the editing got so much more frantic than it already was, but in the same kind of style. And then, I mean, the Jerry Springer bit, loved it. Yeah.
Right, and it's such a small line, and it's relatively late in the movie. This is easily the kind of line you could see where, like, revisions happening. Like, okay, we can cut this. This is a little too much, but I'm glad it's there because it helps the film's personality. Mickey Rourke laying in a shitty hotel room watching pay-per-view porn and complaining that it's not showing the climaxes.
Right, yeah. And then he was like,
oh my God. Come on, man. I paid 14 bucks for this.
I paid $12 for this. Yeah. I think that was a great scene, too, to, like, add to the movie sleaze.
Right, another thing I wanted to bring up that we unfortunately did not have time for, Edgar Ramirez is on fire here. Here's Choco. Great performance, absolutely unhinged, but right, like Tony Scott's direction, there is an understanding and an animating intelligence underneath that. Like, no, this is a guy playing a character. This isn't just, again, right, this is drawing attention to a freak show, not being a freak show. Nico. Great to have you back on, man. This episode was an absolute blast to record, and I couldn't have had a better guest for it.
Yeah, no, it was a blast to be here, and I really appreciate you guys having me on again. I'd love to keep doing this as soon as you guys would want me back. But yeah, happy to talk and happy to be here. You know,
anything you want to plug before we head out?
Tenet. If you haven't seen Tenet, I mean, that's like one of my all-time favorite movies. I watched that recently in theaters in IMAX. I rewatched it, I mean, and oh my God. I mean, I know this is a podcast mainly for lesser known movies and all that. So yeah, but I have to say Tenet.
It's probably going to be back out of theaters by the time this goes up.
Right. Well, watch it on the biggest screen you can find, I guess, is what I would say. Just rewatch it and give it a chance if you didn't quite really enjoy it the first time. So as far as another movie goes, I guess what I would plug is a movie from this year would be Netflix's They Cloned Tyrone. It's not quite the same kind of movie. It's more of blaxploitation. But I feel like with the film grain and the whole theme of exploitation and inauthenticity, it has some similar vibes to something like Domino for sure. And I definitely would recommend They Clone Tyrone if you haven't seen it yet.
Although that film's exploitation pool is definitely a much older school of reference. Glad you brought it up, though. I missed it when it came out. I will definitely be putting it as a priority on the watch list in the near future.
Yeah, it looks really funny.
Chandler, you got anything to plug?
Anything to plug? Not that I can think of. I just saw Nostalgia for the first time. Tarkovsky's, he's one of my favorites. Definitely watch that if you want to get into a mood, think about life. But that was the most recent movie I watched aside from this.
Another title I have yet to see, but I will say this for now, completely different vibe aside. I haven't seen the candle sequence that is the centerpiece of that movie, and it might be my favorite thing Tarkovsky ever directed. Just genuinely masterful stuff. Thank you all for listening. It's been a good time as always. You can find us on Letterboxd, links in the description. And you can find us on Twitter at Warp Celluloid. I didn't address this last time, but I'm not calling it X. There is nothing you can do to make me call it X.
Yeah, follow us on Letterboxd and all that.
Next time, we will also be having a guest on to discuss another even more recent film, a title we will definitely be teasing down the line, this one being another Chandler pick. But again, keep discovering weird movies, keep the good vibes going, and goodbye, everyone.
See ya.